Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Yakir Englander, your host today. The meaning of being an immigrant has changed significantly in the 21st century. The internet, social media networks, cost of travels, homeland products of food that one can find all over the world, working far from home, all bring new opportunities to the idea of living in one place, but still feel deep belonging with homeland. Growing numbers of Israelis are living today in Europe. The book, Leaving Zion, the Israeli Diaspora in Europe, published in 2019, gives us a wide picture of their life, challenges, but also show us a glimpse for a broader perspective around being an immigrant and having a hybrid identity. Some of these Israelis still work remotely in companies based in Israel, in Hebrew, visiting Israel once a month since it is cheap and takes only a few hours of travel. They speak Hebrew with their kids, meet with other Israelis who live in their European city, and use Israeli media. But for the first time, Israelis, that many of their parents are Holocaust survivors who run away from Europe, these children, who are now adult, are coming back, and in a way returning to their parents' homeland. In his book, journalist David Stavro bring us their stories, stories that invite other immigrants and scholars to rethink about the meaning of living in two homes.
Welcome, David, to the New Books Network. My first question for you is, can you share with us about your choice to write your book?
Yeah, well, there's a few reasons why I was interested in the subject, and the subject of Israeli immigrants in Europe. Some of them are more as an observer from the outside, as a journalist, as a writer. But before that, it's a personal interest because just as much as my book is about the people I interviewed, about Israelis who live in Europe who I interviewed, I can't forget that I am one of those people. I am an Israeli who lives in Europe myself. And not only that, I also have kind of a natural curiosity about the subject even before, because I am a son of immigrants as well. In my case, it's kind of a reverse immigration because my parents are both people who came to Israel, made Aliyah from the UK. So I grew up as an immigrant of people who came from Europe in Israel. And today my children are growing up as children of Israeli immigrants who came to live in Europe. And it's not the same. Of course, there's a lot of differences. But it means that any kind of aspects of the life of immigrants in a new country, and certainly when it comes to Israelis, is very interesting. So I'm interested in the way people live and the way what people miss about their homeland and the choices they make when they have to when they have children and they decide all kinds of decisions about what language they talk and what holidays and how they celebrate them and you know, you name it, what food they miss and what music and what culture and what you know, what kind of life they choose to live. So I have a natural curiosity and a natural connection to that. Other than that, I also think it's I have a more, say, a poetic interest because it's there's a kind of curiosity when I lived in Europe for a few years and I met other Israelis who live here. I must say that it was kind of a wonder to see people who live in a country or in a continent which in many ways is the exact opposite. It's cold and dark, and culturally and politically there are a lot of differences, and people live here and make a life for themselves but still continue to listen to Israeli music or still continue to follow Israeli football teams and still continue to read Israeli newspapers and follow Israeli TV series. And seeing that, both for myself and my other people who live here, made me curious to look into it, to search a bit deeper about what kind of life we live and what meaning it has, whether it's social or political and so on and so on.
Fascinating. So we will come to all these questions later. My first question will be, can you give us some details, if they are details, about like the amount of Israeli who live in Europe? I also wonder, your book focuses on more specific places in Europe, and if yes, why? Is it just because you live in more Western or Northwestern Europe? But can you give us maybe a few details, like what are the numbers of people that we speak about? My second question is, can you mention that your parents were immigrants from Europe, from the UK to Israel? I wonder if the Israelis who choose to live in Europe are more coming from Ashkenazi European roots, even if they were born in Israel, or that you can find like North African Israelis or with Israelis with North African roots who decide to go from the Middle East, who decide to go. And also, how many of the people in your feeling, in your interviews, were people who are like you, who are Israeli European in a way, that the parents make the immigration?
Okay, well, that's a lot of questions. And in some cases, it's a classic example of a short question with a very long answer. I'll try to be brief about it, but it's not so simple, because a lot of people ask me, okay, first fact to know, how many Israelis live in Europe? And it sounds like a simple question, but of course it's not. And for two very different reasons. The first reason is there's no list. Right. It's not like you move from Israel to Europe and you register yourself somewhere and then there's a list. That doesn't work like that. So we don't know. There's no official number. But the second reason is more important. And that's because it all depends on how you define an Israeli, how you define leaving, and how you define a European. So, for example, just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about is, there's an engine to the growth of Israeli diaspora in Europe, or a few engines. One of them is the whole world of relocations, people who work for a big company and they move to Europe or to the US for that sake, but we'll talk about Europe for 2 years or 3 years or 5 years or 7 years, whatever the case may be.
As academic postdoc.
Exactly, that's a second engine, postdocs, researchers, and so on and so on. And then, of course, there's others. There's love immigrants, marriages, and things like that. But if you think about the first two, so, people move from Tel Aviv to Amsterdam or Brussels or Madrid or Warsaw, and they know they're coming for 3 years, but then life happens. They meet someone and get married, or they just fall in love with a place, or, other kinds of circumstances. So are they counted in or not counted in as Israelis who left Israel? Or at what point do you decide they're never coming back again? And it's the same for researchers. And there's also other subgroups, sometimes thousands and thousands of people who nobody can really agree if they are considered to be Israelis who left Israel to Europe. For example, Israelis who were born in the Soviet Union left the Soviet Union as it dissolved in the late 80s, early 90s, moved to Ashdod or Petah Tikva or Jerusalem for 3 years or for 6 years or for 8 years, and then moved on to Europe or to the US again. But we'll talk about Europe. So are they considered people who left Israel? Or are they considered people who left the Soviet Union and just made a short stop in Israel? So, and people who grew up in Israel as kids and their parents moved to Europe when they were 16 or 17, are they Israelis? They speak Hebrew, they have Israeli friends, they go to Israel all the time, but they never chose to live. So, what I'm saying is there's no number. But if you insist, In the real world, of course, there are estimations. The estimations are anywhere between 100 and 200,000 Israelis who live in Europe, which is a lot less than Israelis who live in North America, in the US and Canada, or a lot less, if you want to go in another direction, than Israelis who live in the West Bank. But it is just about the amount of Israelis who live in all the kibbutzim in Israel together, or in big towns like Ramat Gan or Kfar Saba. So that's the scale. So those are the numbers. Now, we'll talk maybe later, if you're interested, about who these Israelis are and what you can say about them as a group. But just to address your questions, I would say, I don't know if, there hasn't been too much research, I mean, academically, about these people. So we don't know to say if the most of them are Ashkenazi Israeli Jews, or if they come from other backgrounds, North Africa or the Middle East. And there's a lot of questions you can ask, where they are politically, if they're young or old, if they're more, to the left or to the right. There's a lot of questions, and I looked into it. I can say quite a few people I met to interview were certainly people from immigrant backgrounds in Israel and also became immigrants themselves. I don't know if that's a coincidence, but it is certainly a lot of people that I met. And the choice of why I spoke to people from that country or from this country or from other countries, that's more, I don't know if people are interested in the technicalities of writing a book like this one. It's a nonfiction book. It's obvious that nobody's going to get rich from it. So there has to be some kind of economic model behind it. I'm a journalist. I write for an Israeli newspaper called Haaretz and for here and there for other places. So what I did was that every time I went to do a report in another European country, say they sent me to Brussels. So I just made the visit a couple of hours longer, and I made an appointment with some Israeli who lives there. So it's very, it's true. There's a lot more Western, Northern Europe in my book than other places. But because of technology and Facebook and social media, I was able to kind of back up what I did was a lot of conversations which don't appear in the book. So, if I, for the book, I talked to people in London, Berlin, Copenhagen, Helsinki, Brussels, Amsterdam, another couple of places here in Sweden, obviously, because I live in Sweden. But behind that, there's lots and lots and lots of more conversations with people all over Europe, just that they were, there was a limit to how much I can put in the book itself. But there's more.
So, David, in North America, the Israeli, and again, as we speak about the Israeli-American community, in United States, although they are living in totally different states with different, culture and many hours flight from LA to Boston, however, they still see themselves, they identify themselves in many ways as one big Israeli-American community. Now, I think that it's a lot because of the work of the Israeli-American Council, who focus on creating the local communities, but also to see themselves as one big united Israeli-American community. My question for you is about the Israeli who live in Europe. How much do they see themselves as one big community? How much the Israeli-European who live in Stockholm care and connect and think about what's happening with the Israeli community in Berlin or in Portugal?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think there's a lot of differences here. I'm not an expert on Israeli communities in North America, but I do know about some aspects of it, and I know quite a bit about Israelis in Europe. I would say there's a big difference. First of all, the Israelis in there's much more Israelis in North America, and they're much, much, much more organized. And one of the reasons for that is that although there have been Israelis in Europe for many, many years, they haven't been organized for many years. Mm. So for many years, there were Israelis that were living somewhere in some Jewish community here or there, not connected, relatively new phenomena, which has a lot to do with all kinds of technical progress, low-cost airlines, social media and things like that. There's no equivalent to a big Israeli organization in Europe. What we do have is small local organizations which have been popping up in the last few years in many places, and a lot of them are now starting to discover each other. So you have all kinds of grassroots organizations, I would say, NGOs. You have a, you know, Israeli newspaper here, and an Israeli NGO connects, you know, Israelis for whatever the case may be, sports or cooking or, you know, writing or reading. And these last few years, we've been discovering each other and making it a European project as well. So yes, there is a bit of that. And yes, there's also all kinds of organizations who try to, for example, encourage Israeli leadership in Europe. And they meet each other and have conferences and organize themselves. And when discovering this, of course, the Israeli government, Israeli parliament also send their long arm into these places. So there is a beginning of what has already been going in America for a long time. I don't know where it's going to end. It's yet to be seen. But certainly I can say, and you know, I'm not saying this is a good thing or is a bad thing, unlike a more traditional organization with, you know, budget and money and inner politics you have in other places here, I would say the biggest organization that has to do with it is Facebook. Because, you know, I live in Sweden and I'm a member of, say, at least 5 or 6 different Facebook groups of Israelis in Sweden, not of European, like just, you know, one's Israelis in Stockholm, one is Israelis in Sweden, one is a left-wing Israelis in Sweden, one is right-wing Israelis, because, you know, journalists have to be on all sides. One is, you know, Israelis cooking this, and Israelis like this music, and Israelis do this or do that.
The same people in different groups.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And some of these groups, I mean, some of them are just Facebook, but some of them have a presence in the physical world as well. They arrange meetings, they celebrate the holiday, they have activity for children. So in that sense, it's a lot more, in a way, democratic, a lot more open, a lot less centralized than the traditional way Israelis are perhaps organized in parts of the US. So it is very different in that sense, I think.
So many of my questions will come from my work with the Israeli-American community where I am. And one of the things that we are dealing with is a question that for many Israelis, when they are in Israel, their Jewish identity is being Israeli. It's interesting. It's being Israeli. And in a way, what we think about or what many of the Israelis, when they hear the word Jewish, they think about the Orthodox Jews. And this is something that they do not want to have a relationship with when they are in Israel. Now, in Israel, when you're in Israeli, your Jewish identity is by definition. There is an incredible thinker, even theologian, even that she is a secular, Ruth Calderon, who wrote an article which called Hazimzum HaIvri, the Hebrew buzzing.
Humming.
Yes, humming, right? That when you are on Yom Kippur, which is a holy day in Israel, and there are no cars, the children, the secular children, yes, who are totally maybe atheist, they can go with their bike on the highway and they will not be in danger, right? All of that doesn't exist when you move from Israel to Europe or from Israel to America. And then you need to ask yourself, is my Israeli identity strong enough in order to raise my family, or do I need to do something else? And I am interested if you can share with us, and your book touches it in so many ways, about the other things that they start exploring?
It's a question of identity. I could start with this. There haven't been too many studies, I mean, academically, about the Israeli diaspora in Europe, Israeli communities in Europe, for the reasons I mentioned before, probably a lot less than those that you have in the US. But there have been some studies, and from indications that we have, and I'm saying this carefully because, you know, a lot more needs to be learned about them. But I can say that those who have studied it, and also myself, I met a lot of Israelis, I meet a lot of Israelis. I think the profile of Israelis who live in Europe, certainly of the latest generation of Israelis who live in Europe, they are secular. They see themselves as Israeli before they see themselves as Jews. And of course, you have to remember there's also a subcategory of Israelis who live in Europe who are not Jews. I also spoke to a couple of those as well. Right. But if we're now talking about the Israeli Jews who live in Europe, so they see themselves as Israelis, they see themselves less as Jews. They tend more to assimilate or integrate into European surroundings of the countries where they live in, less into the Jewish communities, the traditional Jewish communities. So an Israeli who's moved to Copenhagen is more likely to connect and to get friendly with his Danish neighbors than he is to join the Jewish community of Denmark, which is important. Again, I'm saying this carefully because, of course, it doesn't include everyone, but it's I think that's the trend. But there are things that are important when it comes to the Israeli and to the Jewish identity. We still, a lot of them, most of them, I would dare to say, really want to hold the Hebrew language alive with their next generation, meaning with their kids. They do want to celebrate the holidays, although it has to be the Israeli version of a holiday. So it's not exactly the same way that they celebrate in the local synagogue, and also not exactly the same holidays they celebrate in the local synagogue. And these are small and important.
Can you give
nuances.
An example? Can you give an
of course,
example?
I mean, an Israeli Hanukkah, an Israeli Purim is not like a European traditional Purim, not, by the way, not a conservative, not a reformer, not an Orthodox one. It's similar, but it's not exactly the same. And then, of course, there are holidays which are not celebrated at all. Your typical religious Jewish communities in Europe, I don't know how many of them celebrate Yom HaTzmaut, Israel's Independence Day. And if they do, it's not the same. And there are differences. It's not the same songs. It's not exactly the same food. It's not only that it's Nes Gadol Hayapo, not Nes Gadol Hayasham, which is a small symbolic example when it comes to Hanukkah, but there's a lot of differences. So I'm saying Israelis who live in Europe, at least the new generation, it's important for them to speak Hebrew, to celebrate the holidays, to maintain the connection with, for example, their parents who live in Israel. So that everyone wants a grandchild to be able to talk with a grandfather and grandmother. That is important, but it's not super important to pay what it costs to join a local Orthodox or even Reform or conservative Jewish community. So that's very typical. And I think, I mean, I spoke to a lot of people about this question, and people gave me different reasons. You know, in Germany, for example, I spoke to people who are... Yakir, אתה שומע אותי עדיין?
כן, אני שומע אותך, כן.
כן, אני מצטער פה, נכנסה שיחה, איך אנחנו...
אנחנו פשוט תמשיך, אני אחרי זה אבדה שמורידים את זה.
אז אני אלך משפט אחורה כדי
שיהיה... כן, בדיוק, זה ממש בסדר גמור.
So in my book, I spoke to a lot of people... Again, in my book, I spoke to a lot of people about why this is a case. And some people in Germany, for example, a lot of people told me that a lot of Israelis who come to Berlin, because there's been quite a big immigration of the young Israelis to Berlin, they don't see themselves as the kind of older, more traditional Jewish community in Germany because they were in the military, for example, they are ex-soldiers, or because they are artists and left-wingers as opposed to traditional older generation. So there's things like that. Then there's all kinds of bureaucratic reasons people gave me about, you know, not wanting to join the local politics or pay the local tax or whatever the case may be. I think, personally, there's a deeper reason, and I think it has to do with a narrative. What story people tell themselves when it's concerned to where their identity is, where the core of their identity lies. And I think that although human beings are complex beings and they have room for more than one active identity, you can be both an Israeli and a Swede, yeah? But I think there's a limit to what... how many active identities you can hold. So what I say now may sound a bit complicated, but it's actually quite simple. I think for me, and I can give myself as an example, although the people I spoke with or spoke to when I wrote the book, a lot of them gave me a similar account. I'm an Israeli, because I was born in Israel, my family's in Israel, my friends are in Israel, I like Israel, I like it when it comes to the culture, the music and the food, I feel at home in Israel, and I have an Israeli passport, and all those things and more make me Israeli, and I'm also Swede, because I've been living here for a few years, by this point I speak the language as well, I like Sweden, I think there's a lot of advantages in Swedish society, and my kids are growing up here and go to Swedish school, and for that reason, those reasons and many more, I'm a Swede. To hold another active identity of being a Jew, I'm not saying I can't do it. I'm saying, but it's, you know, it has to be an extra. It's another spice on top of it. It's not the main one, because a lot of the things that have to do with being a Jew are not so traditionally are not so important to me. I'm not so interested, for example, in the bloodline and the aspect of a Jewish race. As a secular Jew, I'm not really interested in studying Torah, at least not as a daily thing and an important part of my day-to-day activities. I'm not so interested in the mitzvot. So, you know, I'm first an Israeli, then a Swede. And on top of that, I have, and me and many others have, you know, the extra bonus of being a Jew. I think for Jews who live in Sweden who are not Israelis, it's the opposite. They are Swedes and they are Jews. And their Israeliness is an extra. You know, maybe they have a flat in Netanya in Tel Aviv. Maybe they come to Israel every summer. They have family in Israel. They follow, you know, they read the English edition of Haaretz or the Jerusalem Post or whatever the case may be. And they're interested in Israel, but it's not a core part of their identity. It's an extra part. So what happens in reality is that Israel for European Jews is like Judaism for Israeli Europeans. So it's like the extra thing. And I think that's important because in the bottom line, it's important to understand that Israeliness is now an identity in itself. It's not a side effect of being Jewish. There is such a thing as being an Israeli. It's important. And for a lot of Israeli Europeans, it's just as important, if not more important, than the Jewish part of their identity. I don't know if that was clear, but that's, you know, it's about narrative and about identity.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, it's fascinating because in a way it's an anti-Zionist narrative on the opposite, because one of the things that the Zionist movement tried to do is to create, when they came from Europe to Israel, to Palestine then, was to create the new generation of kids who are going to be tzabar, who are going to be natives in their place. And in a way, the people that you speak with, it sounds that they want to create an hybrid identity to their kids, that in a way they will be Germans, but also, and here it's interesting because the Jewish community will say, we are Jewish Germans, right? A part of our Judaism is connected to being German. At least I can say it in the United States. The American Jewish community calls themselves American Jewish. They are Americans. And one of the claims of the anti-Semitic is you have double identities. Right. And in a way, according to what you share with us, many Israelis create this hybrid identity of nations,
yeah,
of two nations. And I wonder about that, and I'm fascinated in something that I didn't find a lot in the book, but you mentioned a few times, what the kids say. I mean, we have, I'm sure you have now the generation, because you speak with some people that you mentioned, they have kids who are now in their 20s. Which kind of identity you hear from the kids? What do they say to their parents?
Okay. I'll answer about the children in a second. I have four of my own, so you know, I know what they say, and I've spoken to other parents and other children. But I want to go back just one second. What you said about Zionism, this is a new concept, and I'm aware of the fact that for some people this is kind of mind blowing and totally like takes them by surprise. But I have to say it because I see it in the way that it's what you said is very true. Israelis live in Europe, whether it's you know in Holland, in Belgium, in Scandinavia, or in France, or in Spain, or in Italy, their identity is composed of the two different nations, the new nation and the Israeli nation. But that is not losing Zionism, because there's one factor which has to be taken in here, and it's a very important one, and it only exists, I would say, in the last 10 years, not more than that. And that's one of the reasons why it's a bit problematic to talk about the children, because they're still too young. But I mean, to develop something as adults or second generation. But what I mean is this, especially in Europe, more in Europe than in the US or in Australia on the other side of the world, because of the internet, because of low-cost airlines, and even because, surprise, surprise, of the same time zone, that's the difference between Australia and the US and Europe, I would say that Israelis who live in Europe still live in Israel. Now, I know that sounds absurd, but in a way, if you think about it, 30, 40, 50 years ago, Israelis came to Europe after the Six-Day War, after the Yom Kippur War. You know, they came to Europe and they stopped being Israeli. To read an Israeli newspaper, they had to go to a public library and pick up a copy of Yediot Ahronot HaMaariv from 2 weeks ago. And if they wanted to talk to their parents or their grandparents, they had to, you know, wait for a very, very expensive, very, very short call. And going to Israel, you know, I've talked to people who came to Europe from Israel on a ship because, you know, flights were so expensive and so rare and such a big deal. These days, all that obviously doesn't exist anymore. So what you have is a generation of Israelis who can live in Europe, but still work in Israel because they work in their laptop and cell phones. They can still talk to their families without paying anything and can do it all the time with WhatsApp and Skype. They can be part of Israeli political discourse because it's all on Twitter and Facebook and, you know, endless other social media. They follow Israeli TV series. They listen to Israeli radio all the time. I'm saying they, but actually referring to myself as well. They can have a double passport, which wasn't the case in many countries before, but is now. They can have real estate in Israel. They can have a bank account in Israel. They can vote in Israel because they can fly there 5 or 6 or 10 times a year and not pay very much for it. So in a way, even though they live somewhere else, they are still part of Israeli society in many ways. Okay, so in that way, they are still part of Israeli society. And this may sound a bit weird, but in many, many ways, what you have is a generation of Israelis when Israeli society itself is becoming more polarized, and there's a lot of differences between, say, Orthodox religious Jews and secular Jews, Jews who live in Israelis, I mean, Israelis who live in Tel Aviv and Israelis who live in the south and the north, Israelis from this group or from that group. So there's another group, and this particular group happens to live in London or in Lisbon or in Madrid or in Rome, but they're still part of Israeli society. So I would say, even go so far as to say that Israelis who live in Europe haven't left the Zionist movement. They just make it a bit more diverse and a bit more complicated and a bit more, you know, 21st century. That said, talking about the kids, the children, I would say that Israeli children who grew up in this kind of identity, the oldest they are now is, you know, early teens. So it's a bit early to say. I think this is the most fascinating aspect of this whole thing. And by the way, I ended my book on this note. The last chapter is about the second generation, and I ended it not with an exclamation mark. I ended with a question mark, because I don't know if what happens here is that the glue isn't strong enough and they will just, you know, dissolve into European society, or if the glue is very strong and what you will have is like a second generation of chalutzim, like you had 100 years ago in Europe, and another generation of, you know, young people with a double identity who live amongst the nations of Europe, want to create a, you know, utopia in the old homeland. Who knows? I mean, I don't know. I can, you know, when I talk to my oldest son, he's 13 years old. He speaks Hebrew. He's very interested in Israeli politics. He loves Israeli music and culture. He loves going to Israel. And, you know, I can imagine a situation that in 5 years from now, he won't be interested anymore. But I can also imagine a situation that in 5 years from now, he'll say, listen, Dad, I want to go back to the old homeland.
Yeah. Which is going to be, it's a very fascinating about to think about these two identities, the hybrid identity. But I want to come back to something that you said before, which is in a way the disconnection from the Jewish local community. And I wonder if you can share with us a little bit more. So in Israel, in the majority of Israel, when you say to be Jewish, is mostly means equal to be Orthodox, because the Reform conservative movement is not so strong, almost doesn't exist. It's mostly come by immigration of American Jews to Israel.
Right.
When you come, and I think, and help me here, that the majority of the Jewish European communities are also focusing on it's coming from Chabad, which is the ultra-Orthodox, or is the Orthodox understanding. The situation in America is very different, very, very different, since the American Jewish community, it's only 10% Orthodox. And I will say even more than that, this is the first generation in Jewish history ever that you have today in North America, more female religious leaders, more female rabbis than men rabbis. So we have a whole new understanding of what is to be Jewish. And I think that the Israeli-American community slowly, takes them time, slowly understand that if they want their kids to be Jewish, the Israeliness, unique as it is not strong enough identity for their children. And therefore, they need to make the efforts to meet with the local American Jewish community in any interpretation that you wish for. And there is no excuse to say, oh, they care, they are too religious for me, because you will find transgender rabbi who fight for Black Lives Matter because they are Jewish. This is the interesting thing, Jewish.
Right.
So a lot of the efforts of the Israeli-American community today is to create this incredible united connection between the communities and with the Israeli uniqueness of your identity. Your kids bring to American Jews the gift that they speak fluent Hebrew, and they know Israeli music and Israeli food and everything else. But it's very important about the future to create the connections. And there was in the past, I will say, even some anger from the American Jewish community, which says, you come to live with us and then you create your island, come to be with us. Let's create these relationships. So I wonder how it's play in Europe.
Yeah, that's a good question. sorry. I found several models. In my book, there's a chapter about Helsinki, which is the capital of Finland. And there, because there's such a small number of both Jews and Israelis, naturally, it's not one of the big centers. It's not London or Paris or Brussels. So what they did there, and in many ways it's a result of a couple of specific individuals. It's not even a big ideology behind it, but people who realize that, you know, if we don't join hands here, So we're just going to lose ourselves because it's just not enough people for having both, you know, an enormous strong Jewish community and an enormous strong Israeli community. And since the people were, you know, by coincidence, or perhaps not by coincidence, they could talk to each other, they joined hands, and they worked together. So that's one example. I've been told that this is like what happens in Toronto, in Canada, and in other places in North America as well, that kind of a model. On the other hand, people talk about Berlin quite a lot. In Berlin, I found hostility and animosity between Jews and Israelis who don't want anything to do with each other. I mean, not all of them, of course, not all of them. But you know, you hear these voices, and not only they don't want to have anything to do with each other, say, okay, you're you, I'm me. We're going to, you know, both go our separate ways. And there's anything in between. There's all kinds of models that I can say, like from a journalistic point of view. But I don't know. I found there's a chapter in my book about Amsterdam where you have a very big, a very strong, a very interesting Israeli community. All of Israelis, I think all of them are secular Jews, but they still see themselves as a part of a Jewish world, as a certain part, as a humanistic, pluralistic kind of Judaism. And of course, here in Europe, you have Chabad, just like you have in other places. And Chabad is really all over the place. And, you know, love it or hate it, they're very effective in the way they get people together and the activities that they do. So there's that. And there's everything in between. And they all, you know, I talked to all of them in my book. So I map it in that way. So that I can say as a journalist, as a person, as an Israeli who lives in Europe, I don't know. What I do know is that if there is to be a connection, my gut feeling is that one of the things that blocks it is that the Jewish communities in Europe, it's not that they have anything against Israelis. It's not that they like them or don't like them or feel hate or feel love. That's not the point. The point is that nothing will go forward until they recognize the fact that Israeliness is also an identity. It's not some Jews went to Israel, some Jews didn't go to Israel, but we're all the same identity. And it's not. Israel has been around for enough years that Jewish prose and Jewish music and Jewish thought, Israeli thought is something of itself. You can love it, you can hate it, you can think it's deep, you can think it's shallow, you can think it's fascist, or you can think it's left-wing, say whatever you want about it, but you have to recognize it exists. Once that's recognized, then you can sit together in the same room and then start discussing your differences and start arguing or start loving each other, or hating each other, or whatever. Until they're not recognized as two separate identities, I don't think we'll go forward. I just mentioned that in the chapter in my book about Brussels, I speak to some people who are much wiser than me in this aspect. Fanny Salzberger, for example, who's a historian who speaks a lot about this and writes a lot about this, and also to the Chabad rabbi in Brussels, who obviously has a different point of view. And I start the chapter off by describing the Babylonian exile. And of course, there's a lot of differences. There's nothing really similar between the situation now and the situation hundreds or thousands of years ago. But one thing that is similar is that you coexist. There's a galut, a diaspora, at the same time as there is an independent state. And that dynamic is something that only came back to our lives in 1948, but for a couple of thousand years didn't exist. And I think it takes us a lot of time to realize that something really serious happened in the last 70 years. And that thing is very important.
Thank you so much, David. So I'm thinking about one of the American Jewish leaders when he worked with, who is deeply involved with the Israeli-American community. He said that Israelis have the first years when they live in Chutz La'aretz, which means that they look at America as if they are going to, they came for a vacation. Yeah, and right. In a way, they only came, they want to meet not the American Jewish community because they don't going to live there, but they're going to go back. They only came for a postdoc, for a few years of high tech. Right. And the identity or the state of mind is, we came for a vacation, let's meet the America that we cannot meet have in Israel. So
So let's leave with the non-Jewish community. Let's see the multicultural, you know. And right. then there is a point, like 5 years after, he said, a few years after the expiration date, when you say to yourself, I'm moving back, that you understand that you don't live anymore in Chutz Laaretz. It's not a vacation, but you are becoming a diaspora Jew. And what you share with us, and I think it's a fascinating phenomena, is that in a way, the Israelis who live in Europe, even if they live there for 20 years, they still live in both places. Like they still didn't open all the suitcase. Yeah. And you speak about the time zone that allow that, the cost was so cheap to fly from many places in Europe, which is interesting phenomena. And it will be fascinating to read your next book that will be probably in like 10, 15 years about the next generation and to see where they are. And also how much it's similar to other immigrants' communities like Middle Eastern, which are, again, in the same time zone, how much they have the same double identities.
Yeah, a lot of it depends on what on the things we talked about, you know, the meeting with the Jewish world and how people experience immigration generally. You know, they're, apart from being Israeli immigrants, they're also immigrants, and every immigrant, you know, and you hear a lot about depression and about finding a hard time to find yourself and reinvent yourself, and you know, just the side effects of moving your whole life from one country in the Middle East to a European country and all the differences and the language barriers and so on. So there's a lot of that as well, which isn't unique to Israelis. And of course, there is the bits that are unique for Israelis, like, for example, the love-hate relationship with the Jewish community is already there, and other aspects as well. But it also depends on what happens in Israel. So there's two sides to the equation, not only the side of the Israelis who live in Europe, it's also what happens to Israelis who live in Israel. Because I can tell you this, in many ways, you speak to a lot of Israelis who live here, when I say here, I mean in Europe, and they are, in many aspects, the same as Americans who live in Europe, or the same as, you know, Poles who move to London, or Brits who move to, I don't know, San Francisco or Palo Alto. You know, it's a globalization and people who, like I said before, work from their laptops and can really sort of exist in a few countries and not bound the weight of, you know, their original nation weighs them down. So there's that. But on the fringes, there's also another kind of sentiment to it, which, you know, I spoke to a couple of Israelis in Europe who are both sides of the political map. One we would call a radical left winger, and one you could call a radical right winger in different countries in Europe. And when you talk to them, you also find a bit of kind of aroma of communities, say the Cubans who live in Florida, or, you know, Persian people who came from Iran and live in Germany, or Kurds who live in Sweden, or whatever case may be. Because as the situation in Israel, you know, when everything in Israel is okay, so that's one situation. But when, I'm not saying if the situation is bad or good in Israel, but I'm saying when there's a feeling of crisis, when there's a war, for example, one of those wars in Lebanon or Gaza, or when there's a crisis, so there is kind of a feeling that people who leave Israel are kind of starting up in another place. And if they maintain the Israeli identity, there's a bit of a sentiment of we'll keep what is getting lost in the old country. Now, this is very sensitive stuff. And I'm not getting into politics now because my opinions don't really matter here. But I think there are people who live in Europe, perhaps also in the US, who are Israelis, and saying we're holding on to our Israeli culture, because back at home, it's all getting lost because of war, because of this regime, of that regime. So although in sort of regular days, Israeli immigrants are just like any other immigrants, in that sense, some people have a deeper feeling of creating, you know, the new Israel, the new, like maintaining the old identity while the old one is getting lost in wars in the Middle East and so on. So that's also an aspect, although I must say that meantime in the real world, it's very hard to find Israelis who left Israel for political reasons. A lot of them may say that that's the case. A lot of them may sort of build that as a, you know, kind of a structure to explain to themselves why they're not back at home. Mm-hmm. But in reality, I won't say 100%, but almost everyone left Israel for different reasons. And then this is a narrative that we tell themselves. We're not really an exile Israeli government because Israel has been taken over by the forces of whatever. But there is a bit of that kind of sentiment in certain circles in Europe, certainly.
So I want to stay with your last sentences and to try to explore it a little bit more, and you touch it in the book. The place of many Israelis who live in North America, they see themselves, I mean, in the past, Israelis told them that they are, they call them in very harsh names. It's like, how come that you leave Israel? However, today, the Israeli-American community, I can say, I think mostly, they feel that, you know, slowly they have a role, and the role is they are totally Americans, but also because of the connection between America and the state of Israel, they see themselves representing Israel, caring about Israel. It's just that they are the ambassadors of Israel in the United States. Yeah. And because of their relationship with the local American Jewish community, they contribute a lot to also to the American Jewish community, mm-hmm. and vice versa. I wonder about that in Europe, because you share about the narratives that they are holding. How much they see themselves that they have a role to represent Israel, maybe not even in the political ideas, but as a culture. Like to say, you know, this is part of our culture. And also I wonder, and maybe I connect two questions, so help me here, David. Many Israelis don't know existentially what is anti-Semitism, because they serve in the military, because Palestinians, most of Israelis don't see them as anti-Semitic. They see them as political, you know, question about rivals. Land. Exactly. Yeah. In Europe, because of the history that you're holding there, I'm sure that many European Jews have a narrative around anti-Semitism. So I wonder where the Israeli European community find itself, how much they need to represent Israel, how much they are having conflict with the narrative about anti-Semitism, etc.
Yeah, well, start from the first part of your question. You're absolutely right. In the past, and I spoke to, when I interviewed Israelis who live here, I spoke to both young ones and older ones. So some people who came here 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, but also people who came here in the 60s and the 70s. And definitely the older ones talked about the days when they left Israel, they were considered traitors. In Hebrew, you have the terms for immigration, you have olim v'yordim, right? Going up and going down. If you immigrate to Israel, you're going up. If you're leaving Israel, you're going down, and you're a traitor. And there's all kinds of awful things they used to say about people who left Israel. These days, that sentiment is much weaker, perhaps in some circles in Israel, doesn't exist at all. There's a lot of reasons for that. Not only how the world became a global place and people became more cosmopolitan and more pluralistic, also because it doesn't really hold itself. A lot of Israelis I spoke to here were very aware of, I mean, it's a lie, because people would say of Israelis that they're traitors if they went to live somewhere else. But the second they become successful, they become again part of a family. So you're a traitor. But if you suddenly become a successful Hollywood actress, you're one of us and you're not a traitor anymore. Or if you came a big shot in Silicon Valley, then you're one of us. And you know what happens every time. You know, I'm Sweden. Every time a Nobel Prize is won by someone who spent 20 minutes in his childhood in some place in Israel, he's already an Israeli, certainly a Jew, won the Nobel Prize. So you know, it's based on a lie, and even not a lie. It's a very natural feeling of, are you with us or against us? Are you part of us or not part of us? And that doesn't carry very much weight anymore. That said, and also what I said before, Israelis who live in Europe today are very much part of Israeli society in many ways, if they choose to. But I also met a lot of Israelis who said, you know, I don't care anymore. I don't want to be Israeli. I'm not interested. So some people are on the side of the spectrum saying, I represent Israel. Every time I get into a political argument, I would represent my old country and stand up for it. And some people say, I don't care about this stuff anymore. That's the reason I left. And some people, you know, on the other side of the spectrum, will be the most active BDS fighters against the, they would say not against Israel, but against the current regime in Israel. So you have everything from one side to the other side. And when it comes to phenomena like anti-Semitism, that's extremely interesting because Israelis don't know anti-Semitism, which, you know, they've read about it maybe, they've heard about it. But when an Israeli comes to Europe and meets anti-Semitism firsthand for the first time, it's a kick in the, you know, let's say the stomach. You know, more than it's painful, it's shocking. It's something that you've read about in a book. It's like going to Mars. You don't believe that someone can actually hate you, not because of something you said, not because of something you did, just because of who you were born to be. It's something that as a member of a majority, a national or religious majority, you just never experienced before. And that, you know, people react to that in all kinds of ways. You can become, you know, extra nationalistic or even racist yourself, or you can become, you know, a humanist, left wing, bleeding heart, whatever. I mean, depending on where you were in the first place. But
it's a
fundamental shocking experience. And I think it's not only that. It's also, surprisingly enough, a lot of times Israelis who come to Europe, at least that's the case in Europe, for the first time, they discover the Palestinians, which is insane because, you know, you live in Israel for 20 or 30 or 40 years. And of course, you meet Palestinians in the public, in a hospital, in a pharmacy.
There is a power dimension.
But exactly. But you never go to school with Palestinians, for example, unless you're in a very, very special school. You never, you know, and here your kids suddenly go to their class and there's both Christians and Jews and Muslims and the people who come from Syria and from Lebanon and from Egypt. And there's all kinds of interesting meetings and interesting, give and take back and forth with people who both, you know, it could be neo-Nazis and anti-Semites, or with Palestinians and Syrians and Iraqis and things, human meetings. Which you, for good, for better, for worse, good or bad, pros and cons, whatever. But you don't have back in Israel, and you know, it makes life richer. Maybe not easier, but there's all kinds of reactions to it. So it's another aspect of being an Israeli in Europe, certainly.
Yeah, I can just guess that for many Israelis, and we see it also with the Israeli American community, they feel unique connections with immigrants from the Middle East because they share the same hummus, they share the same even music, like the melodies. And in a way, it's a surprise they feel more connection as immigrant communities than with the locals, with the natives that see themselves as the other who are coming. You have a chapter.
Let me just tell you on that point that I very much agree with what you said now, and both in my book and I think in the real world, there's, you know, you see the highs and lows of this. The highs of it is when you find these wonderful connections between Jews and Arabs in some European city, sitting together, eating hummus, listening to music, and saying, oh, you know, we actually were very similar. Why don't we, you know, live in peace and prosperity and democracy from now on forever? And now I said it like it sounded like I was sarcastic, but I'm not. It's a real beautiful moment sometimes. But then there's also the downs. I discovered, for example, whether I spoke to people, you know, in this country and that country, young or old, left wingers, right wingers, everyone went through the same depressing experience when the last war in Gaza broke out, and suddenly discovered that, you know, it's all fun and games and it's all very nice and we can create these lovely little coexistence. But when there's a crisis back in the homeland, suddenly everyone sort of curls up into their old armor and you know, people go out to demonstrate and the media is, you know, obsessive with covering more dead children on this side of the border and more rockets on that side of the border. And then everything goes back to the good old hostility, good old it's only us against the world on both sides. And personally, I can say, you know, again, saying as a journalist, not as an individual, that I wish I could say that, you know, the birth of peace and understanding is now being created in the big cosmopolitan cities of Europe. And it is, but it's also, you know, there's every step forward is two steps backwards. And a lot depends on what really happens back home. So in the end, my book, for example, is true that all the people I spoke to are in Europe, but really it's in its heart, it's a book in Hebrew about Israel, and it all starts from that little piece of real estate in the Middle East. And you know, it's this is just a kind of one of those, you know, waves that go to other places, and it's all very interesting, but the heart of it is back home.
And we don't have the time, but there is, I will just share that there is a fascinating chapter that you interview an Israeli-Palestinian or Israeli-Arab, and right. What their relationship, how much do they feel connection with the Middle Eastern communities, how much they are Israelis, and what do they do with this multi, now it's like trio identities that right. challenge. And as you just mentioned, in times of crisis in the Middle East, their identities are clashing with each other.
And in Hebrew, that chapter is called a short chapter about a real exile, unlike, you know, other kinds of exiles, which are more, you know, more regular immigration. But yeah,
yes.
right.
Yes, thanks. Definitely. David, thank you so much for being with us. It's a pleasure to read your book. And we are waiting to read the next one, which hopefully will be about the next generation.
Thank you very much, Yekir. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.